This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rashida Jones, stars with Bill Murray in the new movie On the Rocks, which was just nominated for a Critics' Choice Award for Best Comedy. It was written and directed by Sofia Coppola and draws on Coppola's relationship with her famous father, Francis Ford Coppola. Jones made a Grammy Award-winning documentary about her famous father, Quincy Jones. Her mother, Peggy Lipton, starred in the series The Mod Squad. Rashida Jones co-starred in 7 seasons of the NBC comedy series Parks and Recreation as Ann Perkins. She had a recurring role for 2 seasons of The Office as Jim's girlfriend. Jones now co-stars with Kenya Barris in the Netflix series Black AF and co-hosts a podcast with Bill Gates. In On the Rocks, she plays Laura, a successful writer who's been unable to complete her latest book. She's been at home in Manhattan raising her 2 young daughters and doing the cooking and housework while her husband has been traveling a lot, getting his new business off the ground. She feels stuck and taken for granted, which is eating away at her self-confidence. Although she can't even admit it to herself, she thinks her husband may be having an affair with his new coworker. She starts to confide in her father, Felix, a successful art dealer who seems to know everyone important in Manhattan and constantly talks with his daughter about what men are really like, as if he were some kind of anthropological scholar of masculinity. He offers that, in part, as an explanation for his many affairs, which was the reason Laura's mother divorced him. When Laura tells her father, Felix, about her husband's constant travel and his latest trip, Felix comments that the hotel her husband stayed in is not a place you would stay if you were on a business trip, and suggests it would be a good place for an affair. Laura denies that possibility at first. Here's Bill Murray and Rashida Jones.
There was something.
What?
Never mind.
What?
There were some of his co-workers' toiletries and his luggage.
Sloppy move.
But she couldn't put them in her carry-on through security, so he offered to put them in his luggage. That's it.
Raise your hand if that sounds fishy.
You know what? I shouldn't have said anything. Forget it.
Have you checked his phone?
No.
Well, do yourself a favor. Check his text messages. And it may come to nothing, but, you know, may as well make sure.
Dean is not like you. Okay, he's a nerd. He's a good guy, a great dad.
He's a man. It's nature. Males are forced to fight, to dominate, and to impregnate all females. I remember the first time I saw your mother. It was a beach party. Back then, all the girls wore bikinis. Your mother walked out of the ocean in a white one-piece swimming suit. And that was it for me. I was done. Staying on track, what does Dean have planned for your birthday?
He's not going to be here for my birthday.
What kind of guy forgets his wife's birthday?
He didn't forget. He has a work trip, but we're going to celebrate when he gets back.
That's not the same. I traveled. I never missed a birthday.
Right, but you had some other shortcomings.
Like what?
Rashida Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you on our show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
As a father and as a man, Bill Murray's character is often really charming and charismatic, but he's kind of insufferable and out of touch when it comes to anything related to gender. What do you say to a man like that of another generation who's in your life, whether it's a father or an uncle or a friend of your father's or whatever? I mean, you're fond of them and with your father, you love him. You don't want to kind of lecture him on gender, or do you? I mean, I had issues with my father who grew up in the generation of like women drivers.
Ridiculous.
Ridiculous. So, you know, how do you deal with it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think what's so lovely about this movie is it doesn't really answer that question, because the truth is, I think it's okay to live in the middle where you love somebody who has completely different perspective on the world because they just grew up at a completely different time. And I think there's kind of tender ways and ins where you can talk to them about it. And then there's times that you just can't and you have to sort of let it be background noise, because the truth is, at a certain age, people probably don't change and won't change. But, you know, I think in this film, she has had enough. And, you know, the kind of climax of the film is she just lets it all spill out because she has held her tongue for so long, or she's rolled her eyes, or she's, you know, just looked the other way. And eventually there's just a couple of theories that she just, that just don't sit well with her. And she has to let him know that and let him have it a little bit. So I think, you know, it is, it's that kind of thing. It's like, what are the non-negotiables? Like if you can just decide, like, that's something that I literally can't hear anybody say, including my father. I won't let him say that I'm going deaf to women's voices. That's just not something that's acceptable in my presence. And then the other things, like, I just have to let them roll off because they're never going to change.
So you never say to your father, you're part of the patriarchy.
Oh, what, you mean in the movie or in real life?
In real life.
In real life, no. When I talk to my dad, sometimes I'm like, don't say that. You can't say that. But I also love him. And I, you know, it's followed up with a hug and a kiss.
You made this film shortly after your mother died and your son was born. To lose a mother and become a mother so close together must have been such an emotional experience.
Yeah, this has been a very emotionally intense couple of years. I know, obviously, for a lot of people this past year, but even right before this movie, you know, I mean, it was sort of like back to back to back to back, just wrenching, pulling my heart in all different directions. I for a moment, you know, thought about maybe not doing the movie because it was so close to when my mom passed away, and I was in grief shock. I don't even know if that's a word, but I was, you know, just not in my body at all. And having, you know, just had a baby, I was doubly not in my body. But in a weird way, this movie was kind of a salvation for me, because Sophia is such a tender, present director and friend. And to land in this world for a couple months when I was kind of going through the hardest period of my life was like a real gift for me, because I think I would have probably just been like floating somewhere, you know, in the chaos of my own emotions. So in a weird, very weird, bittersweet way, this was like a really, really big blessing for me to have this movie to go to.
Were there things in the film that you could connect to the emotions you were experiencing and express what you were feeling through this other character?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think the thing that's the craziest about birth and death is just the utter rawness of feeling. Like, I still feel this way. And I think it's like something cracks in you. It's very binary. Both things, like becoming a mother and losing my mother, like, there's my life before and there's my life after. And strangely, there's something that's like not recognizable before those two things happened. And it's just this utter rawness of emotion where, like, doesn't matter where I am, what I'm doing, if I'm overwhelmed by that grief or that joy, that's it. Like, I have to feel that thing. I can't suppress it. I can't run away from it. It's just there. And, you know, that's a nice thing to have, you know, if you need it to go to, and if it's there anyway. So in that respect, I definitely felt moments like very connected to the way that I was feeling. And then I think Laura, you know, she's got this sort of low level melancholy happening, where she's not necessarily depressed, but I think she's searching and she's kind of in this midlife crisis. I wouldn't even say crisis. It's more just like a questioning about, you know, her own self-worth and her own relationship to her life. And all those things I really relate to. And I think nothing brings that into starker relief than, you know, birth and death.
Your character in the movie, Laura, she's a wife and a mother and a daughter and a writer who can't move forward on her book. She's stuck and she starts to not recognize herself. And I think part of it is her fear that her husband is having an affair, but part of it is her life isn't the life she used to have. She's become like the homemaker and the mother, and there's a lot of responsibilities with that. You said that losing your mother and becoming a mother, they were both binaries. They both had like before and after. Did you go through a period of feeling like you didn't recognize yourself anymore and you had to figure out, well, who am I now?
I mean, are we saying that that period is over? Yes. I do think that there's these like big chapters of life. I remember feeling this way a little bit in my late 20s, really having like these deep questions about who I was and like not recognizing myself. And then I feel like I've kind of returned to that a bit in the past couple of years, where like probably not as strongly as my 20s, because I think in your 20s, you're like really not quite sure how it's all going to pan out. Now I'm halfway through. Like, I can't pretend that my life isn't the way that it is, and it's great, and I'm very grateful for it. But I think my relationship with the world and kind of how I see my life unfolding from here on out and what's important to me, and to be honest, my relationship with death, because that's something that really kicks off, I think, in the middle of your life, where, you know, you're invincible until then. And then all of a sudden, you know, you lose the person you love the most, who brought you here, and you wouldn't be here without them. And it really incites this much larger thing, which is like, okay, how do I live my life in a way that will honor my death, my inevitable death? And I know that sounds so heavy, but it feels like culturally, I never even considered that. Like, everything is about like living like you're young, pretending you're never gonna die. And as my dad always says, like, live every day like it's your last and one day you'll be right. There, you have to sort of like now contextually think about your life in the context of your death. And it to me, that makes a lot of sense, and it should be respected and almost celebrated in a weird way. So that's where my head is now.
You refer to your mid-20s when you went through a period of not really being sure who you were or where you were headed. What was happening in your mid-20s?
In my mid to late 20s, I was living in New York. I was a little bit aimless. You know, I wanted to act, but I was kind of dabbling in other stuff. I was engaged. I think I was just kind of like trying to figure out what my life was going to look like as an adult, you know, and also what skills I was going to hone for the next decade, because I think so much of 20s and 30s is about skill building, and in a way that you don't even know until I not that I'm totally skilled, but it, now in my 40s, I think, oh, right, I've been doing the same thing for a couple decades now. So even if I don't feel like I'm good at it every day, there's some stuff that I know just because I had the experience. So I didn't have that then. So I think I was kind of wondering what that was going to be and where I was going to live and what it looked like when I looked outside my window and who I was spending my time with and how I was going to make money and all these giant questions, you know?
Having two parents in showbiz, was your early inclination to find a place in show business yourself or to stay away from it?
To stay far away from it. I didn't succeed, obviously, but yeah, I wanted to go to law school. I wanted to be a judge or a lawyer. And my rebellious identity as a young person was like studious, crossword puzzle loving, you know, I love the idea of like maybe being a humorist or like a novelist and a humorist or a lawyer. I don't know how those things relate, but either way, I love the idea of having like academic structure behind, you know, my identity and my self-worth. So I was like, for sure going to go to college, for sure going to go to an Ivy League school, for sure going to get out of LA, have nothing to do with showbiz. You know, go pursue something legitimate. I say, as I sit in my house in Hollywood, California.
I love the idea that being studious and academic minded made you rebellious. Like, that was your rebellion.
It's pathetic. I know.
No, I think it's really interesting because, I mean, your parents were celebrities. And so what was it that you didn't want that you saw in the world of like celebrity or show business?
There's so many things I didn't want. You know, I have a very, very healthy perspective on fame. And I think a lot of people who pursue things that have either fame as an kind of incidental, side challenge, or actually pursue fame, don't really know what it's like. I've seen it all. I mean, you know, I've seen the ups and the downs. I've seen people rise to success and everybody orbits around them. And then I've seen it all go away. I've seen people handle it well. I've seen people handle it poorly. And I think specifically with my parents, you know, my dad was always notable and well-respected. And then when we were kids and my parents were together, he became really famous, recognizable because of the Grammys. He won lots and lots of Grammys with Michael Jackson for Thriller. And all of a sudden, he was like a famous person. And even though my mom had experienced a lot of fame as a young actress, she sort of like put that aside. She decided she didn't want that. And she gave it up to raise us and to just kind of be in her family. So that when that happened, it felt like it changed the dynamic of our household, and it changed my dynamic with it, because I think in some ways I've always thought that fame has very, very difficult consequences. And I don't think every family, and I don't think every person is designed to carry the weight of fame. I think people think it's this wonderful, magical heal-all, and it's actually the opposite. It's like, it can be a poison. It can be intoxicating and destructive.
Yeah, I mean, your mother says in your documentary about your father that after The Color Purple, which he worked so hard on writing the music, that he had given away parts of himself before, but that after that, like, there was nothing left. He was just depleted. He'd given it all away. And she found that very upsetting, and I think implying that there was nothing left for her. And that's when she ended the relationship. So it sounds like, you know, fame was part of the reason why your parents separated.
Yeah, I mean, he's a workaholic too. I think fame is a part of that for sure, because fame intensifies, you know, what people demand from you. So if you're already, you know, susceptible to people wanting things from you and deadlines and, you know, being pulled on by that, fame doesn't make that any better for sure. And I think, you know, my dad does belong to the world. He's always been that kind of person anyway. Like, even though he has to be internal and create and all this stuff, like, he loves people. He gets his energy from people. He loves to travel. He loves to, you know, meet all different types of people. In that way, he's perfectly suited for fame, you know, and he's good at it. He's really good at it. Not everybody's like that. And my mom was kind of an introvert, and it was hard on her. That was hard on her for sure. You know, I think it just was like the opposite direction of maybe where she thought her life was going, you know. But like all love stories, there's always these things that you don't negotiate until you have to.
Your mother, Peggy Lipton, was white. Your father, Quincy Jones, is black. Has being biracial affected the roles that you're considered for? And I'm wondering if you're ever considered like too light-skinned for a black role or too black for a role that's explicitly or implicitly white.
All of it. Yeah, all of it. Inherently, being biracial, you just live in the middle. You just do. And I'm not complaining about that at all. It is just the way that it is. And the nice thing is that there is some part of that which makes you like a bridge, in a sense, because you kind of always feel like a bit of an outsider. But when I was younger, there was a lot less biracial people on TV and film. So I think people were confused, whether it was because they saw me or they saw my name on the call-in, you know, the sign-in sheet. They were kind of confused how to cast me. And I remember having like panic when I would get cast in something and I had to have a family and I would have to have this discussion with the director or the writer or whatever and say, you know, I want to be represented the way I actually, my ethnicity is in real life. Like, I don't want to cover up anything or whatever. I mean, I think because my hair's naturally straight and my eyes are green and I'm pretty light skinned, the instinct is to not cast me as black. And I think, you know, as things have changed and as there's more mixed families and more interracial families, things have changed. And there's a lot more understanding of all the different ways that biracial people can look, which is great. So there's a lot more kind of understanding, and it's less of a big deal now than it was when I first started acting, which is nice. And I think to be able to play now, to play roles where I get to be, you know, black and unapologetically black, like I am on Black AF, has been such a relief for me, because it's a whole side of myself that I haven't really gotten to play very often.
You've been doing work behind the camera, you know, writing, directing. You directed a documentary about your father, Quincy Jones. And as everybody knows, he arranged and or produced for people ranging from Dinah Washington and Sinatra to Michael Jackson. He's a hero to a lot of rappers. His work has been sampled. He's won lots of Grammys. Your film won a Grammy for Best Music Film. Was making a film about your father a way to ask questions about his life and his childhood that you wouldn't ordinarily bring up with him in conversation?
You know, my dad is a wonderfully open book, and I feel very lucky about that. And I think, you know, he's written a book about his life, and he talks about himself. But yeah, I think when you spend hours and hours and hours with somebody, they let down their guard in a way that they wouldn't necessarily let down their guard if you're just doing a, you know, standalone interview, or even like hanging out as a family. You know, I think just seeing that on screen for me, like, it really told the story of him, like him hanging out with his family, hanging out in the kitchen, eating. That's something, it's a palette that's very different from somebody giving an interview about what they think about themselves. You know, like, there's tacit moments in the movie where we just spend time with him just being quiet that I don't know if you can achieve by somebody, you know, telling you who they are in a way, you know? And then also he told me some great stories that I never knew before. Like, one didn't even make it into the film because there wasn't enough time, but he was talking about Fly Me to the Moon, which is the kind of song, the Frank Sinatra version, that it just seems like it always just existed. It existed before the world existed, because it's such a huge part of everybody's life. You know, you hear that the first four of that come in, and then the little, like, you know, piano, the two piano notes, and you know exactly what's about to happen. But the truth is, he found this song in other words, and it was a waltz in 3-4, and he decided to rearrange it to be 4-4 and swing it, and there is born this, like, incredible moment in songs for everybody to have forever. But, like, he had never told me that story before, you know?
When I was a kid taking piano lessons, I had the sheet music for Fly Me to the Moon, and I want to back you up and say, yes, it was in 3/4 time.
Yes, there you go.
It was
and it was called In Other Words, right?
Yes. It yeah. was one of those parentheses songs, like, yeah, Fly Me to the Moon, parentheses, In Other Words, or yeah, vice versa. Yeah. I'm thinking about how different your father's childhood was from yours. Like, you grew up in celebrity culture. You went to high school with the children of celebrities. Your father grew up on Chicago's South Side, and in the film he says that his father worked for the Jones brothers, no relation, who basically, it was like the black gang that ran the ghetto in Chicago, is the way he put it. And your father says that he, your father, wanted to be a gangster until he was 11 years old, and he literally has the scars to show for it, including one from an ice pick. So it's such a huge contrast to how you grew up. Did you think about that a lot when you were making the movie?
I think about it every day of my life, actually, because, you know, I think about circumstance and luck. So little of what our lives are have anything to do with what we did to get here. And I, you know, I am constantly aware of the luck I've been afforded because of the country I was born, the parents I was born to, all these things I have absolutely no control over. And then I think about my dad, who created his luck, created it. I mean, from nothing, worked so hard and then lived this life filled with love. And no, you know, he didn't hold grudges. He didn't hold on to his anger. And he just kept making things out of love. And it is how he learned how to survive. And it blows my mind every time I think about it. And it also makes me feel, beyond being grateful, I think about like my family history, and I think about where my dad came from. And then I think about my mom's side of the family, and, you know, who's completely Ashkenazi Jewish. And I did that show, Who Do You Think You Are? And we went to Latvia, to the village where, you know, my mom's great-grandfather was born, and the whole village was devastated during the war and everybody was killed. And I just think about how ridiculous it is that I exist, because the lineage on both sides, the probability that I would exist, a Black Jew in 2021 and succeed and thrive, is a miracle. And it's something I do not take for granted. I think about it constantly every day. I don't understand why I was chosen, but I feel like I have to make good on my dad's survival and my family's survival.
So your parents became a couple just a few years after the Supreme Court decision, Loving versus Virginia, which is the decision that abolished any state laws remaining that made marriage between a Black person and a white person illegal. So how accepted do you think they were as an interracial couple? And we're talking about the early 70s here when they became a couple.
Yeah. You know, I think in the country, not very. And I think my Jewish grandparents from the East Coast at the beginning had a hard time with it. And then they loved my dad so much that they got over it. But I think a big part of their existence in California was there was this like beautiful kind of like utopian enclave. Like, we had all these family friends. Like, if you had asked me at age 6, you know, if I knew that, you know, 15 years prior it would have been illegal for my parents to be together, I would have no idea, because we had, you know, all these friends. We had a lot of interracial families that we were friends with, like Sidney Lumet and his wife, and Sidney Poitier, and, you know, Dickie and Minnie Rudolph, Maya Rudolph's parents. So we had all these, you know, my parents did a very good job of surrounding us with people that looked like us and had similar families to us, so it didn't feel weird to us.
So you know Maya Rudolph as a kid?
Yeah, she was at my house the day I was born.
Wow.
She was like 4 or 5. Yeah, our parents were really good friends.
Were you good friends?
Yeah, we are good friends.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, she's the best. The best.
You majored in religion and philosophy, I think, when you were at Harvard, right?
Yes, yeah.
So that interest in religion stuck with you. What were you thinking of doing with it professionally, if anything, when you majored in it in Harvard?
I mean, nothing. Nothing really. I was really interested. We spent a lot of time at a meditation ashram also when I was a kid.
With your mother?
Yeah, with my mom. And I spent some time in India. And I ended up writing my thesis on Indian philosophy, 11th century Indian philosophy. You know, you could do a lot with that in the real world. But I just thought it was so fascinating. And I loved how old it was and how it endured. And, you know, it definitely had some things in common with Judaism. And it was the comparative study of religion. So I got a really good, like, buffet of everything. And I don't know, as an organizing principle, I think religion is so fascinating in its ability to bring people together and its ability to, you know, incite war and violence and just to really create order and get people to do, you know, things you want them to do in the name of God. It's interesting to me.
Did you try practicing other religions when you were studying different religions?
I did, yeah. I even in high school, before I went to college, I was in a Christian choir. I was dabbling in Buddhism. I was going to this Hindu ashram. I was going to synagogue. Yeah, I was loving it. I was going with my friend to her Presbyterian church on Sundays. Yeah, I just was so interested in it. I don't know why. It's weird.
Oh, that sounds great, though. It sounds like such an education, too.
Yeah, and it was cool to see. I think also the music part of it, just to see the music that came out of religion, because that is where, you know, so much music comes from. I think that was interesting to me, too.
Did your father go to church?
Yeah, he did. My grandmother was very religious. And, you know, we definitely had a Baptist history, a lot of Southern family members, Baptist history. But
so were you raised in the church, too, as well as in going to synagogue?
Not really. You know, it's weird. Like, my only real experience with church was, this is sounds so Hollywood, but when my dad was filming The Color Purple, we went to set, and there was a scene when Celie was at church, and I remember being so blown away by the music and wishing that I had that experience a little bit more as a kid. But yeah, I had the Hollywood set version, the Steven Spielberg directed version of church.
How much time did you spend in the studio with your father, watching him, like, conduct or arrange or what, you know, watching musicians perform?
A lot. I have some great memories. I was just talking about this the other day, actually, because we were talking about Westlake Studio, which is in LA. It's kind of, you know, iconic studio. And we went back there to record some stuff for the movie because we recorded this original song that Mark Ronson and Andrew Wyatt wrote for the movie that Chaka Khan sang. And then we got kind of all the original guys from the Thriller era band, like the studio guys, like legends, to come and record. And it was so crazy to be back there because we spent so much time and it felt so big and fun and dynamic. And it's so tiny. It's just like this tiny little place, but I was so tiny. And we spent hours and hours there. It was so fun. Those are really great memories for me.
What kind of instrument or instruments did you play, if any, when you were young? And what about singing?
I played piano, and I still play piano for my own enjoyment and nobody else's, because I would never make anybody suffer through that. But I kind of peaked as a classical pianist around 10. I was a big Chopin fan. I practiced all day and night, much to the dismay of my older sister on her, you know, big piano in her house. I play guitar really badly. And yeah, I sing, and I sang in every choir, and I sang a cappella in college, and I was music director of the a cappella group in college, the Harvard Radcliffe Opportunes. You know, I sing a little bit here and there. And I'm a dabbler and I'm an enjoyer, and I will continue to be a student of music, but I will always feel humbled by it in a way that will make me not pursue it, hopefully. Hopefully I don't have too much of a midlife crisis.
You know, in your documentary about your father, there are scenes of him, or a scene of him, in the ICU. You're there with him after he was in a diabetic coma. And so, you know, he has tubes coming out of him. Did you have any reservations about showing him in such a vulnerable condition? Did he know you were coming in with a camera?
Yeah. Well, the truth is, we filmed that stuff not for the documentary. We were in the middle of filming the documentary, and my dad collapsed and went to the hospital. And, you know, obviously, we stopped shooting. My brother and I took video of my dad in the hospital to show him when he came to, because he had been drinking a lot. And we were making this big plan around intervening and, you know, if he made it out, thank God he did, letting him know that we care about him and he can't drink anymore. So that was really the intention of shooting that stuff. And then after the fact, after my dad recovered, thank God, and by the way, woke up and said, I'm never going to drink again at 82, and then never had a drink again because he's a beast and on a different level his character is unlike anybody I know. But after all that, Al and I discussed, you know, using that footage because we wanted to tell that story. And my dad was incredibly generous about letting us finish our movie before he saw it. Like, he did not micromanage any of it, and he wanted to see it in its entirety when it was done. So obviously, had he had any issues with that particular part of it, we would have taken it out. But we wanted to tell the whole story, and that's part of the story, you know?
Was the problem with alcohol that he was, that he'd gotten addicted to it, or was the problem just the diabetes, that the alcohol was bad for the diabetes?
I think both. I mean, I think he's, you know, been drinking his entire life. It's part of being a musician. It's part of being on the road. It's part of traveling. It's part of having fun. It's just, you know, he's a night owl. He's up all night. He's goes out. Like, that's, you know, it's part of the lifestyle. So, you know, whether or not he would ever say expressly that it was a problem, it was absolutely a problem on every level.
Right. So in a way, like, the diabetic coma saved his life by...
Oh, 100%. 100% saved his life.
So, you know, we talked earlier about how you, in spite of your reservations about showbiz, you ended up having an acting and writing and directing career yourself. How did you get into comedy? Why did comedy become what you're best known for?
Well, I was always into comedy from a very young age. I was obsessed with Saturday Night Live. My parents would let me stay up to watch it, and SCTV and the show that was on HBO, not necessarily the news. I loved sketch comedy. I loved parody satire. I loved Airplane and Amazon Women on the Moon. And I don't know, maybe that was just like an escape for me or something, but I don't know. It also felt fun. It felt fun way to spend your time. I don't think I ever had ambitions of, like, you know, of exercising all of my, you know, emotional demons in public. But I did like the idea of the rhythm and the kind of the almost like song-like quality of comedy. It's very musical in a sense. And, you know, I did a little bit of it in college. I did the female version of The Odd Couple and a couple other shows. And strangely, freshman year, I did a play with my friend, became my friend, Michael Schur, who, you know, went on to be my boss because he created Parks and Recreation. But I had a ton of friends in college who became comedy writers. And, you know, I think being friends with funny, witty people at a certain age makes you want to, I don't know, do that for a living.
I see the connection between your music background and comedy, because comedy is so much about timing.
Yeah.
You know, we talked earlier about your parents' fame and what fame meant to you, and seeing, like, the downside of fame in your family and also in their friends. You became famous, I think your fame, like, really grew with Parks and Recreation, because you were on that for what, 7 seasons? It was an incredibly popular show. So how did you decide to deal with the fame of that?
Well, the funny thing is, it was not an incredibly popular show. Now it is, but when we were on the air, we were almost canceled like a half a dozen times. Like, not that many people watched it, and we always felt like we were on the bubble. There was several different presidents of NBC that wanted to cancel it and then got talked out of it, or canceled it and then changed their minds. And we were just getting, like, little pickups here and there, 6 episodes, 12 episodes. So it didn't feel like a successful show. I mean, it did from the inside, in the sense that the cast loved each other. We loved to play with each other. It was such a dynamic writing staff and cast. And every minute of shooting that show was so enjoyable, truly every minute. And I think everybody who was on it would say the same. But then Netflix happened, streaming happened, and that show is, it's sort of rewritten as this enormous cult hit. But the truth is, it wasn't when we were on, which is probably good because it meant that we could just sort of enjoy each other there, you know?
So finally, when I see QAnon referred to as Q, I think, like, I remember when Q just meant your father.
I know.
Now it's just like conspiracy theory group.
Oh, no.
What's that like for you to see Q all the time now?
Listen, Q will always be my dad. I don't, whoever that other person is might not even exist. So they don't get to take the thunder. And hopefully the legacy of my dad and his, you know, enormous life and contribution will be the only Q that people remember. Hopefully this will fizzle out.
Rishida Jones, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You too. Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Rashida Jones stars in the new film comedy On the Rocks, which is streaming on Apple TV+. Her documentary about her father, Quincy Jones, is streaming on Netflix, as is her latest TV series, Black AF.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars, and let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
If you'd like to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed, like this week's interviews with New Yorker staff writer Elizabeth Colbert, whose new book is about efforts to reverse some of the harm humans have done to the natural world, or New York Times cybertech reporter Nicole Perlroth about cyber attacks on the U.S. and how American cyber weapons got into the hands of our adversaries. Check out our podcast. You'll find lots of Fresh Air interviews. I'm Terry Gross.